0818-715-815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan with you until 3 o'clock today. And like I say, a lot of you, we have one eye on a screen in the corner here where the girls in green are putting in some performance. So exciting, so tense on one level to get a goal that early and then to think about, can we hang on for across the 90 minutes? We'll keep an eye on it. We'll watch it if you are not able to. So, and if there's any changes there, God, it's pouring down where we're watching it now. If there's any changes there, we will get them right to you. Yeah, really Irish. Maybe that's helping us there. It's a very, very Irish day there. You can hardly make out through the teeming rain, make out what's happening. I see there's a Canadian player on the ground there. We're just a few minutes short of half time. But as I say, we will keep an eye on that as throughout the programme. Now, I want to bring James Hastings. James, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me on.
James, you have been through the most torrid time. And up until a few months ago, everything was grand. You had no notion what was coming down the tracks for you.
Absolutely. Until I went into hospital on the 26th of May with a suspected gallbladder problem. I had no idea I had any issues like
what,
this.
What were your symptoms at that stage?
My symptoms at that stage was I was showing signs of jaundice and I was yellow in the eyes and in the skin. And the local GP thought it was most likely gallstones.
Right. And what age are you, James?
I'm 41.
And you have small children?
I do. I have three boys, 13, 9 and 4. They are brilliant. Yeah.
Okay. So you go in, you get, at this stage, you're not that worried. You think it's something that can be dealt with reasonably handy. When did you realise it was more serious than that?
It took 2 weeks of lots of tests, scans, scopes, and doctors prodding about, kind of trying to figure out everything. And then we were told it was cancer. The word cancer was shocking in itself, but it wasn't the end of the world at this point. Not just yet.
And what kind of cancer specifically?
So at this point, I just was told it was cancer. Then another week passed, and a few more tests and a few more meetings and scans and scopes. And then I was told it was colon geocarcinoma, which is bile duct cancer. And it was at the level of stage 4. So it had spread through the lymph nodes throughout my, picked up in 4 other areas of my body.
And is it a rare cancer, bile duct cancer, James?
It is a rare cancer. There are 200 cases a year in Ireland. So that makes it pretty rare. Like, you think 200 cases doesn't sound that rare, but it is very rare.
Okay, so what were the doctors like? What kind of prognosis did you get at that stage? What was they telling you in terms of treatment options?
So the oncologist was quite clear that the level of care in Ireland for colon geocarcinoma stage 4 is just palliative care. So the recommendation was to go on a chemotherapy and to apply for another drug that might give me a bit more chance.
Did they actually use that language? They talked about palliative care to you at that stage?
Absolutely, yeah. There was no, in that meeting, there was no hope given beyond the chance that there was a 5% window that I might be reactive to an immunotherapy drug.
Right, that must have been just devastating. I'm just thinking about your 13-year-old and your 4-year-old.
Yeah. Gut-wrenching. Like, it was the worst hour of my life. I would never want anybody to go through it. And it was just devastating. Yeah, there's no nice way of putting it.
So you made further investigations. And what did that lead you to?
I did. And just to be fair to the oncologist, he said, you know, it is palliative treatment. And I was like, what do I need to do, doctor? You tell me what I need to do and I will do it. I said, I can do whatever you tell me to do. I will do it to beat this cancer. And he said, unfortunately, that's not how it works in this situation. In Ireland, it's palliative care for cholangiocarcinoma in stage four. He said there was no hope of surgery, no hope of anybody looking at surgery in Ireland. And in the world, he was pretty sure nobody would look at operating at this point.
And were, so, was he giving you a time, you know, how long you had, basically? Did they talk in those terms?
They didn't talk in such terms because it's a rare type of cancer and it is an aggressive cancer. So on average, people with cholangiocarcinoma don't last 2 years. Like 2% of people get past 2 years.
Following diagnosis?
Following diagnosis with stage four, yeah.
Okay, so a pretty bleak outlook, to say the least.
Very bleak. Like the next few days after, the oncologist did say to us, if it's going to be beaten, if there's a chance, you have to do the research. You have to find out where you want to go, what you want to do. And we will, if we can, help facilitate getting into some clinical trials. But that was the only glimmer of hope. And it was very bleak. Like, there was a whole hour of a conversation and that lasted a couple of seconds.
And were you there with your partner was with you for this, or were you?
Yeah. My wife, Marion, was there with me for this, and my mother-in-law, Kath, I have to say, was brilliant. She came along, and thank God she did. She held us together through it. Amazing woman, amazing lady.
Yeah, I mean, it's hopefully not many of us will ever be sit in an office and get told this and what passes through your mind at that time. As I say, especially, of course, if you have small children at home.
Absolutely.
That changes everything, really, doesn't it?
It does. Absolutely. So over the next few days, as you would when you're told you've got very little time to live, the doctor, I asked the question to the doctor of, do I live this summer like it's my last? And he said, absolutely. You do what you can because it's going to progress. It's going to get worse. So over the next few days, we got my affairs in order. I did what you would do, kind of check your will, check your mortgage, life insurance policy, all the different pieces to try and make sure that in the event of the inevitable that we were kind of told would happen, that the people left behind will be looked after. It was absolutely gut-wrenching. And it was the last week of school before the school kids broke up. So I cycled the kids to school a few days, thinking that is going to be the last time I'm ever going to be able to cycle my boys to school. It was so emotional, so hard to do.
As I say, it's unthinkable, really, to be faced with that sort of a diagnosis and that sort of a prognosis. Can I just ask you, work-wise, were you able to take time off work immediately, or what's your situation there?
Yeah, I had my own business called Tyre Aware in Ballandarin, it was a tyre centre. Unfortunately, because I'm self-employed, there isn't any illness benefit or anything like that. Now, I had no choice but to stop working because I didn't have the strength to continue working. So, I'm not working currently.
Okay, but you got your affairs in order. And again, we're only going back a couple of months here. Like, this is three months ago, you knew nothing of this.
This is less than 2 months ago. Yeah. This is like when I was cycling the kids to school, it was a month ago.
That's
how quick.
But as you say, you started researching yourself.
Yep. So I started researching, started looking into the possibilities and the more I researched, the more hope I gained. I was really kind of putting all my eggs into the one basket of being in this 5% chance, because that would mean the immunotherapy drugs would be reactive to my cancer. However, the more research I did, there's a cholangiocarcinoma.org website in America. It's amazing, all the different systematic, all the different therapies and different treatments you can go through. There is hope, no matter how far or how bad you think it is, there is always hope. And that's one of the main things I really want to get across to everybody. If you're sitting in a doctor's office and you're told there's no hope, get a second opinion and get an opinion from a specialist. It's very important.
So tell us about the glimmer of hope that you came across then.
So the glimmer of hope was the immunochemistry reports came back and said, I'm reactive to immunotherapy drugs. Absolutely amazing. Top of this world. I was like, yes, there is a good chance of beating this cancer.
And just to explain to people who wouldn't be familiar with this, there is a very small percentage of people who would be diagnosed with the kind of cancer and the level stage that you're at that would fit into the category that would be considered very good candidates for immunotherapy. Am I right in saying that?
Absolutely, yeah. It's quite detailed. It's a MSI high is the actual clinical or the medicinal term. And it means that there is a genetic mutation in the cancer cell that can be affected or can be treated with immunotherapy drugs. Immunotherapy drugs really get your own immune system targeting the cancer and beating the cancer by helping it target the specific cancer cells.
So this is the best of all possible news if you have been diagnosed with a devastating cancer.
Absolutely phenomenal.
So.
However, yeah. There's more to this roller coaster that I'm on. And I was told, yes, this is going to be reactive to a drug called durvalumab, which is manufactured by AstraZeneca. And I was like, brilliant, let's get this drug, let's get going, let's get saving my life. And then the hope that I was given was ripped out from under me because the HSE will not pay for this drug because it is not yet licensed in Ireland.
Yeah, it is, I suppose, just for the technical part of it, it is licensed for lung cancer, am I right in that? But not for bile duct cancer.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the very frustrating things. I can be going in. I've got chemotherapy tomorrow, and I could be going in to my chemotherapy chair, and the guy next to me or the lady next to me might be getting durvalumab through their infusion because they've got lung cancer. They've got a different type of cancer than I have, and it is licensed for that, but it's not licensed for cholangiocarcinoma because it's so rare.
So frustrating.
It is very frustrating. And there's even another level of frustration, I might add, if you don't mind. Uh-huh. And that if I was I don't have private health insurance, but if I had private health insurance, the private health insurance could not ethically refuse me access to durvalumab because it is the standard of treatment worldwide. To have GemCis chemotherapy and durvalumab is the starting point of treatment for anybody with cholangiocarcinoma, as seen by all the experts in the world.
So if you were a private patient in any of the Irish HSE hospitals right now, you would be treated with this drug?
Absolutely, yeah. To the best of my knowledge.
But you're not. You don't have health insurance. And you have appealed. You have appealed to the HSE in relation to this?
I've appealed to the HSE and I've appealed to the political system. And the political system, it was brought to the very top level of the Irish political system. And unfortunately, there is a body called the NCPE set up in 2013. And that prevents both the HSE and the political people to interfere on a case-by-case basis. So there are no workarounds that, as far as I know, the Taoiseach in the country knows about, that the ministers I've spoken to know about. Everybody's been working their absolute hardest to get me this drug because it's not licensed by the NCPE.
That's the National Centre for Pharma Economics.
Exactly, yeah.
And this is, we hear about them from time to time because there's campaigns for particular drugs. There've been some very high profile ones, and Vicky Phelan led one of them.
Absolutely.
And this is the body that basically weighs up whether or not they can justify licensing this drug for a particular, because it is a very, very expensive drug, isn't it, James?
It is expensive, but it's not expensive when you look at it in relation to a lot of the drugs that are licensed. It's €10,990 is the cost price of a single dose, and a single dose would either be on a 3 week or a 4 week cycle. So I'd get it once every 3 weeks or once every 4 weeks.
So it'd be, yeah. So what's that, 11 grand a month? And would it be a long-term treatment then?
It all depends on how it reacts with your body. If you go into progression of the cancer, you might go on to a different type of treatment. Or if it actually starts to cure the cancer, you might stay on it for longer. It's all questions. You know, because it's not a very well-documented cancer, it's a learning game all the time. And nobody really knows the definitives.
Right, but we're talking about a substantial amount of money, and I know that you didn't want to have to do it, but I know you've been forced to try and raise money privately on a GoFundMe page.
Yeah.
But you have been told that this is being looked at by the National Centre for Pharma Economics, and that it is, the process is underway. But what did they tell you in relation? This is just in the last few days you got the latest news on that.
Yeah, the process is underway, but it could take anywhere between 6 months and 18 months. It all depends on everybody agreeing on the prices, the meetings to happen, it to be top of the agenda. There are so many variables. The bureaucracy is just too much.
And of course, you don't have 6 months or 18 months to play around with.
No, I don't. I don't have any time to play with. Every day to me is the equivalent to somebody my age of a month and a half in life expectancy.
Yeah. And so, have you told your boys what's happening? Do they have any sense of what's going on here?
Absolutely. We had to tell them. I'm straight up and honest with everything in my life. And we had to tell them because community engagement and everything, you know, it's devastating telling them. And I have to be 100% fair, Cancer Care West was a great support in helping us get the tools required to talk to them and how to talk to them. And anybody with cancer, I would highly recommend you talk to your local cancer advisors, because they're amazing. They work with people like me every day.
I know there's some really unbelievable work being done out there by all sorts of organisations, and indeed hospices are brilliant as well, not just for end of life care, but for pain management and all of the all of the wraparound care that people need when they've got a really serious diagnosis, like yourself, James. Yeah. Is there any hope that this process can be speeded up in terms of, you know, the process that's now being looked at to possibly license this drug?
I haven't been given any hope that that is the situation. I believe they will look at it in their time and license it in their own time. There is no pressure that the government can put on them, nor the HSE, as far as I know, because it's an independent body. They just work by their own law. And that, to me, in itself, is totally wrong. Modern medicine moves at a speed unbelievable. Like, these kind of licensing processes should take a month. Once something is licensed in Europe, it should take a month to get it into the Irish health system, because it will save lives. And not only will it save lives, it will save money, because instead of treating a cancer patient with the wrong drugs, the wrong medicines, they're going to be treating them with the best and the newest, and they're going to get the best outcomes.
I know, just the absolute frustration to know that there is a drug there and that you are one of the tiny percentage of people that it could have a massive effect on, and not be able to access it immediately must be just such a head wreck, is all I can say. I mean, I can't even imagine what it does to your head. I mean, if you do manage to raise money, can you Can you, what do you do? Do you go abroad for the treatment, or can you get it? Can you get treated here?
Unfortunately, I'm probably going to have to go abroad, because last week I raised this with my oncology team, saying that the HSE probably won't get the right results for me. So we need to get it in process so I can buy the drug, or raise money and buy the drug. They were like, yeah, it should be no problem. So I got back onto them again this week, and then they raised it to the head pharmacist in UHG, and the head pharmacist said, we can't do that because public patients in a public hospital getting treated by the public system cannot differentiate between two patients whether they can pay for extra drugs other than the patient who can't pay for extra drugs. So I get their logic behind it, but surely on a case-by-case basis, stuff like this should be able to be looked at.
How are you keeping yourself going, James?
I'm keeping myself going by my family, my community, and the fact that by raising awareness in this whole campaign, I'm hoping and praying that other people are not going to have to do the same thing. I have said, since I got the diagnosis and I started researching it, I said, no matter what happens after this cancer and after I beat this cancer, I'm 100% committed to beating this cancer. I'm going to make sure that other people do not have to walk in my footsteps, because it's wrong. Everybody has hope.
James, I wish you the very, very best of luck. We will keep in touch with you. And
can I just give a shout out to my Facebook page, if that's okay?
Yeah,
just
go on.
If anybody wants to follow my story, it's James Fights Back on Facebook. It's very easy to find.
Okay, James Fights Back. James, good luck in that fight. You have a lot to fight for. You have a lot to live for, and the very, very best of luck to you and your family and your community
One last point is that something like this can happen to absolutely anyone. So it's important that everybody is aware of this situation and everybody is trying to fight to get the system changed so that it is good and works properly for everyone.
Yeah.
I do want to just give one shout out as well to all the good people who do work in the health service. 99.99% of people go into the health service with the clear ambition of helping people. And I say thank you to all of those people, because they are brilliant.
Yeah. Well said, James. Well said. That is James Hastings there from Kinvara, who is putting up, as he says himself, the fight of his life. We'll take a break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, I didn't want to interrupt James there, but unfortunately there has been another score in Perth, and it's by Canada. So if you're not near Italy, I'm sorry to tell you that we are at 1-1 now. We're still in the game and playing very, very well. Canada have clawed one back there with us. So it's 1-1 in Perth. And as I say, we will keep an eye on developments there for the next hour. Charlene, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how are you?
Charlene, we've been coming back to this again and again because we're getting so many calls in on it for the last number of days since that horrific attack on that tourist in Dublin city centre. Really shone a light on what is happening in the centre of our capital city at the moment. And you got in touch. You're a student teacher at an English school in Dublin.
Yeah, no, at the moment I'm working with the most loveliest Italian students that are over here for the summer. And I'm doing English through drama. And it's been amazing. They're so good. Like, they're a credit to their nation. I've been working with them, going through, like, you know, their experiences and what they've been doing. But every morning they just come back to me, like, they've been getting attacked in Temple Bar.
And so what age are we talking about here, Charlene? What age are these students?
14-year-olds, 14 to 16.
Are they allowed to wander around Temple Bar on their own?
Oh no, they have their. Oh, so I'll read it back a bit. So each day there's activities. So we'd have activities with going to Cliffs of Moher, going to Galway, and then you'd have on the list an activity to go into Temple Bar. But unfortunately, I think what's happening is there is too many attacks in Temple Bar, and I think it's going to be taken off the list unless there is something done in the next 2 weeks, because there is students still coming over to this country to do this course. And the course is actually funded by the Italian government through the PRSI scheme. Their parents are all civil servants, they're all teachers, doctors, guards, and they're entitled to come away and spend 2 weeks to a week in Ireland and learn the language and experience the culture. But I think what's happening now is they're having a bad experience. It's embarrassing. And as a teacher, I just feel for the next 2 weeks, what's going to happen? There's another flight arriving on Monday, and will they be attacked?
So what are they telling you, Charlene? As you say, you're working with them, you said teaching through drama, which must be great fun, actually.
Yeah, you're going through all the poems. We're talking about the greats. We're working with Oscar Wilde. We're like, you know, giving them all the culture that they need. And there was an exercise that they write a postcard home. And I was expecting to come out with the lesson plans that we spent hours working on. And everything was about Temple Bar and being asked, do they want drugs? You know?
Really? Like, and these are 14 and 15 and 16-year-olds?
Yeah. And they're trying to sell the students cocaine on the streets in Temple Bar. So,
what else are they telling you about their experiences in Temple Bar?
This morning I got, and this is why I was really upset, because one of the students got hit by a bottle. Like the glass smashed all over the floor.
This is obviously, is this in the daytime? This is when they're going in?
In the daytime, yeah. It's just unfortunate that, you know, I have a few friends that are guards. I'm not saying that, you know, we do need more guards. It's not fair on the people that are guards right now, because they're bombarded with the work. They're not babysitters either. They can't control the fact that our youths are in the city allowed to do this. There should be youth centres, there should be all of those things implemented for this to stop. But I think if there is a plane load of students coming next week, we're saying we want new guards, that's not going to happen. So is there an option to get the army out? Is there anyone around to protect these students? Like the guides that they're with, they're in their 20s. They're, you know, terrified too. I think they came out of McDonald's one of the days and the shakes got knocked out of their hands.
It sounds a very, very extreme. I mean, I would have thought maybe one of those experiences, but you're saying that this has become a kind of a daily issue for them.
Yeah.
And are they, like, what is their sense of it then? Are they nervous going into town now?
Yeah, so today they're going to Grafton Street, which is fine. They're going to have a lovely time. But I think that it's going to be sad if Temple Bar is taken off the list for activities. It's going to be sad, even though it is an absolute rip-off at the minute there. And they are paying through the nose for the Dublin jumpers, but they want that. That's a part of their tourist, their hot, like they want to be a tourist in Temple Bar. But if that gets taken off the list, what's going to happen to those shops? You know, what's going to happen to those pubs that actually serve a purpose with the music and the experience that they get when they're up doing the Cayley dancing? Like Temple Bar, it should not be taken off the list because of a few teenage girls ruining it for everyone else.
Okay. I'm just going to tell you while I keep you there, Charlene, that Canada have just scored. So the first Canadian goal there was actually an own goal by Connolly, but they have scored now just in the last minute. So that's disappointing. So Canada are 2-1 now. That is disappointing because Ireland has been playing so well. Yeah, there it goes in. They're just showing the replay on the screen there on the corner as we go on. Okay, so that's that is unfortunate. We'll keep an eye on what's happening there. Charlene, will you hang on because I want to bring in Katrina. You mentioned the guards there. Katrina, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
There's been a lot of talk about guards and the need for more guards and the fact that we have a recruitment crisis in the guards. And I know that the Taoiseach was quoted in the last couple of days as saying it was going to be very hard to meet the government target of 1,000 new Gardaí this year. You have your own story in relation to this.
Yeah, I emailed in today because I just found that so frustrating when I read it in the papers. A few years ago, myself and my husband decided to partake in career breaks. I'm in a different sector and my husband was a member of One Garda Síochána and he worked in Dublin. And upon returning from our respective career breaks, we went away single, the two of us together, and we came back married with two children and one on the way. Our original hometowns were in the West, and so we had a house in the West and a farm to look after, as well as a mortgage. So when he reapplied to come back from his career break, he asked, could he be stationed anywhere around the West or anywhere near our living area? Because with the housing crisis and everything in Dublin, we couldn't afford to move our family of five, now six, up to Dublin, couldn't find accommodation, and then we couldn't afford to be renting a room for him for the days that he was working.
So when was this again, Katrina?
This was just last year, 21, when we moved back and we reapplied to for his career break to end and to come back. I was due to have a baby in February of 2021. And his return to work date was February of 2021. We were given three options. Try and take another career break, which was not feasible because we had ran out of the years. Option number two was return to the station that he was left at. And option number three was to resign from the guards. There was no help. There was no advice. There was no, let's try and get you in a station, you know, in and around your now new living area. And so we went back and forth for a few months until he in the end had to resign from his position.
And what was it explained to you? Was it that there was no vacancies in?
There was vacancies, yeah. There was vacancies. Well, from what little we knew, there was vacancies in the stations in and around our area. We'd say 30, 40, 50 kilometres in our area there was. There was availabilities. He had his next step up exams done, so his sergeancy exams he had completed and finished. He wasn't a sergeant when he left, but he had them completed. And so he could have gone into either a, you know, a guard position or a sergeant position. There was, and but the point was that they wanted him back in his Dublin City Centre job, and they wouldn't accommodate any other anything else, and we couldn't afford it. We couldn't move our family, and so he had to resign.
And as you said, was it purely for you and your family and your husband? It was a matter of economics, was it? I mean, was it that he didn't actually want to work in Dublin anymore?
No, he did his years in Dublin. He had done in total about 6 years in Dublin as well. He loved it when we were up there. We both lived up there, and he loved it. He loved his the people that he worked with. You know, it was great. And we just decided to take the opportunity when the career break arose to take it. It wasn't a matter of, you know, we needed to get out and we hated Dublin. We both loved Dublin. We both had a good life up there as well. The opportunity came, we took it. And then obviously moving back with a family of three was obviously, with three children, was a lot different than being single up in Dublin. And we couldn't afford it economically either. Financially, we couldn't afford it. And the fact that we had a family roots, obviously, down here where we are right now, and a farm to take over from my parents as well. You know, it was the opportunity to live down here at home that we wanted to have. And it was black and white. It was, you know, go back to Dublin or not. And I understand that people are on you know, lists in the guards to get moved to stations as well for years and years and years. And I completely understand that. But it was just black and white. There was no individualism to look into people's different situations. And instead of looking into our situations and maybe thinking, you know what, instead of losing, you know, an experienced guard, let's try and station them somewhere. It wouldn't have been favouritism. It would just have been looking at people's individual situations a little bit harder than what they did. But No, there was no option.
I know, but I mean, I know, Katrina, and I'm sure when you saw that they're acknowledging really that they probably won't hit that 1,000 Garda recruitment figure, and we know if we've been listening to the Garda representative body and the Association of Garda Sergeant Inspectors, they've been warning for a long time now that they're having a real issue with recruitment and with retaining Gardaí. So you're saying you there was your husband wanting to stay in the Guards, wanting to serve, but being told that it was Dublin or nowhere else. But
that's it. And they're talking about 1,000 recruitment Guards, but they're not talking about how many Guards they're losing as well. So, you know, you can recruit 1,000 Guards, but how many experienced Guards have they left already in 2022?
Yeah.
I think it's up in the, you know, the three digits now. I think it's a couple, you know, there's 100 and something already left this year between retirements and resignations.
But I wonder, is it when you hear Charlene's story of what her students are experiencing in the city centre, is this one of the reasons that they're of, there must be a struggle to get Gardaí to take up postings in those Dublin Garda stations?
Well, you know, you don't have an option when you come out of college. You're stationed, you're given a station, and that's what you're given.
But you don't want those.
Yeah, everywhere.
Sorry, but Katrina, I was going to say you don't
in
want
right now. But there's sorry, go on.
Sorry, Katrina, I was just going to say you don't want a situation where those Dublin Garda stations are populated totally with raw recruits. Surely.
No, that's true as well. But also there's need for Guards in every other station as well. I know it's highly publicised right now in Dublin, but there's, you know, there's incidences all over the country as well of antisocial behaviours, burglaries, Guards that are taken, you know, because they're not in it, the numbers aren't in it. And it's so unfair for the Guards that are currently serving right now. And they're getting the bad rep that they can't make, you know, if someone breaking into a house, they can't get there in time or anything like that. And it is so unfair, but there is a need for Guards. But when they're not treating the Guards that are currently serving with respect in the way they should, then this is why there's resignations. So even if the new recruits do go into Dublin, you're not having the older recruits there because they are resigning.
I hear what you're saying. And I'm sure that people will say, look, surely to God, I know there is a huge need for Guards in Dublin in particular, but there's a need for Guards everywhere, I think. I think that's...
And when it was the situation of losing, you know, losing an experienced Guard over, you know, not going back to Dublin as well. Surely that they didn't want to cut off their nose despite their face. Surely they would have kept him in the force. Would have kept the numbers. You know, that's my situation anyway.
Okay, Katrina, thank you for that. Farah, can I bring in Farah now? Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon, Kate.
You're Italian yourself, are you?
Yes, I'm from Rome.
And Charlene there was saying her students are a credit to your country. I'm sure you're delighted to hear that. How do you feel about how long have you? You've lived in Ireland for a long time.
Long time, over 40 years.
Okay. So how do you feel about Dublin now? Has it changed over those years?
No, it hasn't. Kate, I can tell you, probably weren't born at the time. It was in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. And there was a fashion in the north side to throw bricks or something at the passing by car with obviously a woman inside to steal her handbag. That went on for a long time, and it was exactly the corner of Garner Street at Summerhill. One night I was coming back from work, and I stopped at the traffic light, and I noticed there used to be from time to time a guard at the corner on Garner Street at Summerhill at the traffic light. And I noticed it wasn't there. So my alarm system went on in my head, and in 1 second I looked at the rear mirror, I pulled my gear backward, reverse, and as I was doing this, two guys arrived and broke into my window. But obviously they trained themselves to go forward. They were not trained to go backwards, so I went backwards for about 30 meters. Luckily, no car behind me. So eventually, they let it go.
Okay.
So as soon as they let it go, I took off and I went to the guard station. And I said to them, I said, where was the guard? He's gone for tea.
Right.
And I said, well, could you not take somebody? Because everybody knew that at 6 o'clock and at 9 o'clock, the guy was going for tea.
Okay.
A friend of mine had his mother in the car, sitting in the passenger seat. She was hit by the brick, few stitches on the head, and a shock.
This is
that was it in the 80s.
Oh, this is the 80s. So this is, as you say, this a crime.
Because back then, the drugs weren't so fashionable. So they want the cash.
What I mean, you still live in Dublin, Farah?
Oh yeah, but no, I haven't been. I was just saying, I've been to the gate because they had their own car park, as you know. Yes. But I haven't been to the Abbey for maybe 35 years, because there's a car park at the end of the road, but there's about 50 minutes to go on that road, and there's nobody there, and there's no way that I would do that.
So
at this stage, you're not even safe to go out at the Abbey for a cigarette, because that poor Croatian got hit, and he still has the mark on his face.
That's the Ukrainian actor that was...
The Ukrainian, exactly. I saw him the other day with that lovely mark on his face, which is awful.
So you're obviously a big theatre fan, Farah.
Oh, yes. But I'm afraid the Abbey can come to my house, but I'm not going there. Because, you know, why put myself into trouble? Because the corporation, they're making life. They changed the trees. First of all, the trees were original one and were native. They put this tree. They think you clean up a road and make it more fashionable, changing trees. And no police. You go to Rome, there's police everywhere.
I was going to say...
You can't move an inch in downtown. In fact, there's two trucks always parked in the Spanish Steps beside us. Just where the metro comes, the exit of the metro. And they're stationed there. No moon, no night and day. So everywhere. You go to Paris, they don't take prisoner there. You go to Spain, they don't take prisoner there. Why you have to ruin your own town, your own city? It's drugs, we all know that, and it's just gone off. Marlborough Street, that was famous 100 years ago because it was so dangerous. And I remember, I know it sounds silly, I remember there was a lady that I knew very well, and she's the old stamp, and she insisted to go there because there was a place where you could get the double cream, the English double cream that she loved. Mm-hmm. And she used to go there on her own. She said, they wouldn't touch me, I'm too old, and get that bag for me. But even that time, it was a no-go area. Even though at that time there was not that many drugs like now. That time they were after money. But that area has always been a problem. Until the drugs and the police comes around, up and down, and also this guy, this young little one, they have no respect for the police because they see, they're not coming down. They're afraid of us. That's the situation.
Are the police in Italy, the police around Rome, would they be armed police? Or
I was going to tell you, of course they're armed.
Yeah.
Of course. Any police in the world is armed. You go to Spain, you go to France, they're armed. And they also have the baton and all that kind of stuff. They are very well protected, and I can tell you, they don't take prisoners.
Yes, but I suppose a certain pride is taken in the fact that we have an unarmed police force and that they...
What for? That's silly. What do you want to be proud for? To send these people, not armed properly, to put up with these drugs, syringe, attacked, broken bottles, a knife? You're not protecting the police at all. Don't feel proud. I feel ashamed that this country's gone to where it is. And it's not my country. It's ridiculous. Why do you want to feel, pride that, why don't you send little children then to police the town so they're not armed either? You can go down to Canal Street at a certain point because, God forbid, that you have a bicycle or a phone and you'll be hit. There was a German child, a student last day, was massacred. Why do you want to be proud? Proud of what?
Well, I think the view is that the police force police with the support of the community largely and managed to do so pretty well without having to resort to...
Oh, yeah, pity that people get hit with broken bottles, this guy hospitalized, and then you feel, oh, my God, the American embassy. The American embassy, of course, is doing this because it's protecting their own... citizen, that's what for. Not because they're protecting the Irish tourists. They had to protect their own American citizen coming here.
What do you tell your friends, your Italian friends, Farah?
I don't say anything because it annoys me. Why we always talk about this anyway? We don't. We have other things, more important things to talk about it.
But would you warn them about walking around Dublin City Centre is what I'm wondering.
Of course. I remember my cousin years ago came and she took one of these buses, you know, that you up and down and all that.
Mm-hmm. The hop on, hop off, hop off.
Yeah,
hop off.
Yeah, exactly. So I said to her, do not get off O'Connor Street. Now, if I said it once, I said 150 times. But as you know, professors, they know always better. She was a professor of mathematics. So, she, of course, she stopped in O'Connor Street. So she rang me from there. I said, what the hell are you doing? Do you know what? They were trying to steal my phone. I said, well, I did tell you not to go to O'Connor Street. What are you doing? And she said, I want to see, you know, the post office there because of this story. I said, will you get off on the bus again and get out of there?
Okay,
she wasn't shocked because being Rome, you know, you always expect something might happen anyway, so you're ready.
Yes, indeed.
You know what I mean? We are more on the alert. Here, you're more relaxed, but then you get hit.
But isn't that the thing? I mean, I know tourists who go to Rome and go to Naples and other, you know, major Italian cities will be warned, watch your bag.
Of course, watch everything.
It's not unique to Dublin.
Even when I meet people that I don't know, but they say they're going to Rome, I tell them, don't wear jewellery, don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other, don't go certain places. Of course, I tell them.
Okay, Farah, I'm going to have to take a break. Many thanks for that. We'll talk to you again. Take care of yourself.
Okay, take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And you're welcome back. And we are going over to Perth live now to Samantha Librera. Samantha, how are you?
Hi, Katie. Well, we're here in the Rectangular Stadium in Perth. Ireland currently in possession. They've picked up in the last couple of minutes with the number of substitutes. That Katie McCabe sensational start, the goal from the corner in 4 minutes. Ireland dominated the whole of the first half and they were fair to be disappointed with conceding that goal in the fourth minute of injury time just before half time.
Yeah, I took my eye off the screen because I was on a call at that moment. Samantha, can you tell us what happened? It was an own goal, was it?
Yeah, there was a cross from Julia Grosso. It was very wet at the time and it seemed to slide and then hit off Megan Connolly and then it was recorded as an own goal. Now at halftime, Lucy Quinn was replaced by Abby Larkin, the pride of Ringsend and someone who made a real difference when she came on in that last game against Australia. But Canada, since the second half began, they seemed much better organised and they were pressing forward. And in the 52nd minute, Adriana Leon put the ball past Courtney Brosnan and that made the score 2-1. Now there's been a couple of changes and you know Vera Pauw isn't known for making lots of changes but I suppose she finds herself in a situation now where there's I suppose nothing to lose. Anya O'Gorman was replaced by Marissa Shiva. Canada continued to dominate possession, so a couple of minutes later Amber Barrett, who scored that famous goal that got us to the World Cup, Izzy Atkinson and Lily Ag, they replaced Farrelly Caruso and Little John, and Ireland have looked brighter since. There's been a couple of shots on goal, Niamh Fahey being the latest there. The crowd are doing their bit, you can hear the olays in the background.
I can really hear it, yeah. It sounds like an amazing atmosphere there, Samantha.
Well, they've really picked up and gotten behind them since they fell behind. And you know, I think you're a little behind what I'm seeing here. But, they are doing their bit here. But Ireland do need a draw here or they need to win. And if the scoreline remains the same, our hopes of progressing in this tournament are over. But if they can equalise and, most importantly, hold it, then they can keep the dream alive. But what, there's another 15 minutes and 15 there's
minutes
a lot of
probably,
injury times in these games at the moment. A lot can happen in that time. I'll be back to you if it does.
Samantha, thanks a million. So that's 20 minutes to keep our hopes alive of getting out of the group in the World Cup. So everyone, as you can hear, really, really electric atmosphere there. Everyone, huge amount of that crowd in Perth behind Ireland. So come on, you girls in green. Okay, we'll keep an eye on that as we go. Thanks to Samantha there in Perth. Now I am going to go to Glenn. Glenn, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie. How are you?
I'm good. I'm a bit disappointed by what's going on at Perth. I don't mind. I don't mind telling you.
Oh, come on, the girls agree. We live in hope, you know, hope. And cheer them on and goodwill. That's what we need. We need the goodwill.
Okay, tell me, you are in the bouncy castle business.
I am, certainly.
And there is a new scourge has arrived on the scene that the is insurance. Literally eating up your business.
Yeah, insurance was our biggest scourge. And now, as part of the IIHF, we are insured, so it's great. And now the next scourge is the robotic lawnmower, which is lurking from the depths of the gardens and coming out and eating our bouncy castles at night time and during the day.
So these are, and I know a lot of people will swear by this now, the robotic lawnmower. I mean, it's like a thing of fantasy that all you have to do is program your lawnmower and it does the job for you. So what's
going on? Have you got one?
I don't have one. No, it's
I don't have one either. I have a young lad who I pay to cut the grass, and it's great because at least they have a bit of money in their pocket and they don't have to be ringing me the whole time.
Right. But it is. I mean, it's for people who don't have a lot of time on their hands or who don't have a handy child that they can bribe into doing it. They're a bit of a lifesaver, I think, for a lot of people.
They are a lifesaver, but they're also, for the bouncy castle business, it is a major problem. And it's becoming more so of a problem because there's a lot of people buying robotic lawnmowers. Some of the big superstores are now selling them at rock-walking prices compared to what they were 3 or 4 years ago, where they were 4,000 to 5,000. So a robotic lawnmower isn't an intelligent system. It doesn't understand the difference between a piece of plastic on a ground or a piece of grass. It still will go over it. And with a bouncy castle, when they are deflated and when they are let down, that is when the robot lawnmower will come along and usually go along the edge and shred the whole castle along the side. And it could cause anything between 100 up to 1,000 euros worth of damage. And people just don't understand this, that the robotic lawnmower won't stop. It will continue until it gets stuck and keeps on eating up the castle or runs out of battery and it can't get back. So it is a massive scourge. And it happened to me only a few weeks ago, one of my castles. Client rang me and said, look, after having an accident here, and I went, okay, what's after happening? Came up and had a look, and the robotic lawnmower had gone on the middle of the castle and had gone about 20 foot down and had made shreds of the whole castle from that 20 foot.
So who is liable for that then?
Who is liable? Very simple, is with the IIHF, we have...
IIHF is...
The Irish Inflatable Hires Federation. Okay. We're a group that have come together. We're fully insured. We operate under EN 14960, which is safety standards. And we have terms and conditions in our contracts that when we set out an inflatable, it is up to you to keep it safe. It's like hiring a car, that if you hire a car, that if you crash it or if you cause accident to it, you are liable for it. So the owner is liable for any damage that is caused to a castle. We say to everybody, if we see a robotic lawnmower, please switch it off. Don't put it on sleep mode. Don't plug it out. Just switch it off totally until such time as the castle is collected. And a lot of times in our modern society, it's very much convenience now. So some people forget about this and they don't kind of remember the robotic lawnmower and they think, sure, it's not going to do any damage. The amount of tents that I've seen destroyed by these lawnmowers, and people don't really talk about it that much because there only could be about 50 or 60 quid. But once the tent comes down, the robotic lawnmower goes over. It doesn't stop. It only has a boundary wire and it's able to get on top of these flat surfaces.
So if I have rented, how much does it cost me to rent a bouncy castle these days? What's the going rate?
A bouncy castle from an IIH member, which is insured, and it will be from 150 euros, starting for a good combi, up to 250 to 300 euros for an obstacle course, which is good value, especially if you're getting weekend hire.
Okay, 250 euro. If my robotic lawnmower has a go at it, you're saying that could set me back 1,000 euro on top of that?
It could. It all depends on the level of damage that is done to the castle. The castle must be fixed to the safety standard, to the EN 14960. You can't just patch it up with tape or glue it together. It actually has to be brought back to a repairer that does a proper job that will pass the test. because all our castles are tested and to make sure that they're safe for use. So that castle has to be repaired back to the proper job. It's like a car, if it's bought back or a piece of equipment for a hire company, it's standard across all hire industries. It must be brought back to an acceptable standard that is safe to use.
Can I ask you something, because I don't have one of these lawnmowers myself. Is it a case that you can tell the lawnmower to pre-program it, basically, to say at 4 o'clock, you know, tomorrow or 4 o'clock every four days, you do a round of the lawn? Is that how it's done? I mean, I can't imagine somebody coming out and setting their robotic lawnmower to work knowing that there's a bouncy castle in the middle of the lawn.
But the thing is, this is a new thing, the bouncy car, the robotic lawnmowers. So a lot of people don't think about that. Like, this happened to me a few years ago, and it's quite interesting. It was my son's communion, and I went into church, and I was sitting down, and I'd hired out a castle to a neighbour. And he went, "Glenn," it was after being a bit of an accident. So I says, "What's happened? The lawnmower's after going over." And I went, "What do you mean the lawnmower's after going over?" And he goes, "The lawnmower's after driving over the castle." And I went, "Ah, no, it couldn't." And lo and behold, it did. So it's only in the last while that people are starting to figure out about these robotic lawnmowers. Like, they're becoming really, really popular now at the moment. And, like, it's in our terms, in my terms and conditions, is please switch off a robotic lawnmower. And when I get on site, I also say to the customer, look, if you have a robotic lawnmower, switch it off. You can make it come out at certain times, but you're safer. Because a lot of them have random patterns where they don't follow the same route the whole time. They come back and forward. So you're better off just switching it off until the time as the castle is collected.
Because if it's not switched completely off, you're saying it could just take off and do its bit.
It all depends on what they have programmed, like what time they have to come out, also the weather conditions. Like, you can program these robot mowers to do an awful lot of things. You can program it to do a certain area. You can program it to come out at night. You can program it to come out when it's dry. But our advice to everybody is, once you get a castle, switch it off until such time as the castle is collected.
I'm thinking, like, we have a lot of, like, cats that wander into our back garden, or if you had your own pets or bunnies or... I'm now thinking, having a robotic lawnmower in these circumstances, unless you are very, very clued in as to how to program it, you could find a lot of things on your lawn.
Yeah, like, unless you don't like the cats and you let it off after.
Usually with
robotic lawnmowers and wildlife will run away from these robotic lawnmowers. It's with a castle and with something that is, a castle becomes very, very flat. This is the problem, that it goes up over the castle. When something's not as flat, it hits off it and it returns back. So say if the blower is there with the bouncy castle, it'll hit off that and it'll return. But once the castle is down completely flat, that's when it goes over. Wildlife, I haven't heard of any wildlife getting run over by a robotic lawnmower yet. But there probably will be time that it will happen. We will hear of a case of something happening.
But bouncy castles are...
it happens... It's huge. Just in our organisation, I was chatting to two or three guys, they're going, yeah, especially during May when it's a really busy season, they're going, I got a robotic lawnmower after going over my castle. As I said, does anyone have a spare castle to help us out over the weekend? Like, that happened to three or four members over the May period. Not as much now, because people are getting much more clued in and going, look, please switch off your robotic lawnmower, especially when you arrive. It's one of the things that we would do now the whole time, going, please, and we've now put it into our terms of issue in your book. If you have a robotic lawnmower, please switch it off. So you have to click on that now to make sure that you know that there is a danger out there with a robotic lawnmower.
Okay. I have Jerry on the other line. And just to say before I bring you in, Jerry, we're just gone into the 85th minute now in Perth, and it's still 2-1 to Canada. So time is running down there. We still have to get a goal back to stay in with a chance to get out of that group. But we're keeping an eye. Jerry, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Come on, the girls agree. We need a robotic goal scorer, I think.
That is for sure, Jerry. Jerry, you. Am I right? You mend these when you've repaired the bouncy castles.
I manufacturing and repairing bouncy castles, and over the last couple of years, as Glenn was saying, there you get an awful lot more damage, and the damage to it, Katie, is severe. I was just talking to somebody the other day. But last year, somebody rang me. I was in town in Drogheda, and they called me up and said, I think there's a bit of damage to your castle. It wasn't my castle. It had my number on it because we were manufacturers. But I said, I know the chap who you've hired it from, and he's very decent and he's very proper. But he brought it to us for repair. The thing is, the damage was so severe, Casey, that this castle has to be returned back to the way it was. So its second-hand value remains proper, and also, as Glenn said, so it's back in a safe working order. We had to get cloths in. This cost that particular client, and I didn't think it would be so bad, it was the worst one I ever saw, was €1,400 was his price for repair on the castle. I mean, it was you know, a third of what the castle cost. It was dreadful for a family.
That's a fairly extreme. And as I say, but I mean, there must be a right boon for you in terms of your repair business, Jerry.
You welcome that. I mean, you have dogs tearing them apart in gardens as well. They get annoyed at them.
Dogs love them.
Yeah, but they're left out. They bite at the corners. But a robotic lawnmower will do the worst. Now, the lads are getting very used to it. So they're used to, unconsciously, we have a thing where you do a routine inspection after every hire with the IIHF, and you say, is the blower right? Is the mats in place? Are the pegs down? And we must add to that now, is there a robotic lawnmower? Look around, ask the person, because they're very conscious. Well, it's very upsetting for the customer to lose, like, and that's an extreme, to lose €1,400 on a repair. But remember, the operator who has that castle, it's out of service probably for a good few weeks, because like the repair people like ourselves, we have to get specific cloths back from the manufacturer, so it all lines up, and it can be quite a hassle for the person who's hired. He doesn't want it to happen. They don't want it to happen. You know?
Okay.
It's an impact on their livelihood as well when a castle goes
Well, that's what Jerry. That's Jerry's point there, that you're out of commission. I just want to bring in Bernard now, because we were talking about what else might get attacked by a robotic lawnmower. Bernard, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. So just on the topic of the lawnmower, my son has one, and about 3 weeks ago he sent me a photograph of a dead hedgehog and a lawnmower right beside it. So that really is annoying. So to me, I wouldn't be a fan of robotic lawnmowers, to be honest.
Why? Just because of exactly this point?
Oh, well, for that reason, but they go day and night if you set them that way. And they cut the grass within an inch of its life, that no small flowers can grow or pollinate. And so, so for that reason, I would rather cut my grass at a higher level and do it manually.
Yeah, well, of course, there's the whole No More May movement as well, in terms of letting the pollinators have a go at your garden before you go at it over the summer, because of course that's the whole new movement now, is to leave the gardens grow to promote biodiversity and all of that. So poor hedgehog was dispatched.
Probably, yeah, and God knows whether it was a male or a female or not, and maybe young to feed or something on that line. So we don't know that.
And is this, do you know, does your son have a program to come out at night to do the?
Oh yeah, it's just what your friend there was saying. He's a wire around the edge of the garden, and it runs to that wire, and that's his territory.
Right. Okay. Okay.
And runs day and night as well. Yeah.
Okay. So. Glenn, there's one for you there. You were saying you hadn't come across any wildlife being attacked, poor hedgehog.
I say there's a small insects and stuff like that are getting trampled by robotic lawnmowers. Look, they are a great benefit as well, especially if you're time poor. They give you time back. Like with my garden, it takes me 2 hours to cut, and once it becomes a meadow, like I'd be even cutting it even more. As I said, they are great things, and they do make your lawn look really, really well. as I said, that's one thing. I'm kind of slightly jealous of people that do have the robotic lawnmowers going, that's a nice looking lawn. But as I said, there is dangers associated with them, especially with bouncy castles and stuff that is flat. But it's just a little bit of as I said, in the IIHF, it's what we do is promote safety and awareness. And if you're hiring off an IIHF member, they'll alert you to that. Robotic lawnmower that it should be switched off and everything like that, you know.
Okay. Just to tell you, we're past the 90 minute mark now in Perth. They've added on 5 minutes injury time, so we have 5 more minutes to go, and it's still 2-1 there in Perth. I just want to bring in Bill now. Bill, good afternoon.
Katie, how are you doing? Bill is my name. I'm good, thank you. Katie, I put my new robotic machine going yesterday.
Yes.
First time ever. And it's fantastic.
And why did you want a robotic lawnmower, Bill?
It was a fad, I suppose, really. I was buying them more. And when I looked at the prices, there was very little difference. Now, the one thing I would advise people to be careful on is some of the mowers, you have to turn them upside down, get a wrench to adjust the heights. And on the one I got, I'm lucky enough, there's a switch on top that you just adjust the height. But I cut away all day. I didn't have it cutting at night. So I cut no animals.
No hedgehogs were injured in the making of this lawn.
No hedgehogs, and it did a fabulous job. Now, it takes a while. It takes a while for the mower to get used to the size of the garden, and it after a few rounds, it programs itself and it gets used to where it's going, and it gets used to the shapes, and it does long runs. But it did a lovely job.
And do you have to be careful with it? Like, do you have to be if you wandered out into the garden while it was at work?
I don't want to contradict the gentleman that was speaking about the play area at all, but anything that we put in front of it, and we actually put things in front of it just to see, it immediately turns around and goes out the opposite direction.
Right, okay.
It
takes off. I'm told I have to take an ad break. Stay with me. We'll be back after.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we are down to the last minute and 10 seconds in Perth. Samantha?
It's not looking good, Katie. You know, there'd been some hope here. 78th minute, Katie McCabe weaved into the box and took a shot, but it didn't go in. Then she took a corner, but it was fisted away by the Canadian keeper. And Ireland overall have had a lot of attempts. It's very reminiscent of their performance in the last few minutes against Australia. Lily Ag took a shot outside the box in the 89th minute, but it just didn't have enough power to make an impact. In the 90th minute, there was a lovely cross from Marissa Shiva, but the Canadian goalkeeper got to that now. There's a bit of play here in front of the box, but no, the Canadians are back in possession. Coming to end. The rain is pouring here, and unless they pull off something in the next minute or so, that's it for Ireland in terms of progression in their first ever Women's World Cup.
Oh, it is just heartbreaking. I'm just watching the clock count down. There's only the last few seconds left.
Look, you can see the frustration in the players' face. I've seen Amber Barrett here, you know, a number of times going forward, looking for assistance that she didn't get. And, you know, they have really, really tried here. But the Canadians came on in the second half much more organised. And once they got that second goal, Ireland have been on the back foot ever since.
Yeah, Samantha, thank you so much. It looks like curtains for our chances there. That's it for today. We're out of time.
Stand by for rain on 0818 715 815.